Wait a second. I just got a message on LinkedIn that says, I know this should probably be on Reddit, and it is a video. Should I play it right now?
Let's play it.
Okay, we're about to do the intro of this pod, but I'm going to play it, and then we will do the intro. But this literally just happened in real time.
Hey, what's going on, Samir? My name is Carson. I am a... we're connected, obviously, but I'm a subscriber of the show.
Oh, no, Carson. Oh, no.
Yeah, and that's the last we heard of Carson. And
oh, no. You know. All right, well, welcome to this episode of the Colin and Samir Show. On this episode, Colin, what are we talking about?
All right, today we are diving deep into Elon and Twitter. We're going to be talking about how to launch merchandise, getting out of your YouTube bubble, and then what to do if your editor abruptly quits.
Also, I just want to say, Carson, feel free to send that message again, but it didn't come through. Message was not clear. Looks like an exciting video to watch. Love to answer your question on the next episode. Send the video again, and this time, check your audio. All right, let's get into it. All right, a lot to cover this week, Colin.
Is there anything that's happening outside of Elon and Twitter? Because I feel like that's the only thing.
The main thing is that you have gone viral on LinkedIn.
Well, you know, it was bound to happen, Samir.
It was bound to happen right at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah, but your post where you shared our gold play button, viral, I would say. How many impressions does it have?
Let me look. 79,737
79,000 impressions.
What can I say?
That's high.
Yeah.
That's great.
I'm learning.
You're learning, man. That's good.
People were excited about the play button.
Let me tell you, by the way, just to, you know, speak a bit about LinkedIn before we go all in on Elon on Twitter. I got such an exciting message on LinkedIn from the VP at Cinemark Theaters. And Cinemark Theaters is now starting to partner with creators to bring creators' films to the big screen. And they're starting with Yes Theory and their film Project Iceman, which is going to be available in 150-plus theaters in December.
That is so exciting.
That's crazy.
And I was telling this to you yesterday. I feel like if Cinemark makes that a real thing where creators can actually release their films in select theaters across the country, that will be a new landmark, a new goal for a lot of filmmaking-based creators.
I mean,
you can imagine Johnny Harris,
totally,
right, making something that's feature length. Mm-hmm. It would be so cool to be able to watch in a theater.
The thing that I wrote on my LinkedIn was, digital audiences crave physical experiences. And I think that is becoming increasingly more true right now, where you're experiencing like this desire to connect in real life with the community of people who watch the same content as you or share the same interests. I think we're about to see a whole crop of physical experiences. Even being at the Yes Theory premiere was so interesting here in LA with, you know, 600 people, and then seeing how it went globally in Europe, 1,900 people. Like people are wanting to go in person to experience a community.
Yeah, I mean, we're social animals, right? Like we want to be around other people, but social anxiety is also a problem. And that's where I think going to a movie is a wonderful middle ground. Because you go, you don't really have to talk. You just get to sit and enjoy something together. And then after, you have something to talk about.
It's the part of going to the movies that bothers me.
That you can't talk?
Yeah.
Oh, that's where we are so different.
I know, you and I are very different human beings.
I love that I don't have to talk and no one talks to me for an hour and a half. It's great.
Man, okay, last thing I'm going to say before we get into the Musk Twitter deal. I was at a creator dinner the other night and Jordan Matter was there. And I wrote down something he said about our show, which was one of the most interesting lines I'd ever heard someone say. He said, "What I like about your show is that I get to hang out with you guys and a big creator without the pressure of having to contribute to the conversation."
That's what I'm talking about. That's the movie.
That's so interesting.
You get to sit in the seat, just enjoy it.
But what an interesting comment about listening or watching to our show. That he gets to enjoy it without the pressure of having to contribute. Like you're at the dinner table with people, but you don't have the pressure to have to contribute. I'd never thought about that. I think it's a fascinating comment on podcasting in general.
Yeah.
So
I feel that way often when I listen to podcasts or when I watch shows.
Wow. When I listen to a podcast, I'm like, I wish I was in this room so I could add to this conversation.
Where we're different. It's amazing to me that I'm even a podcaster or a YouTuber. I can't believe it.
Okay. All right. Well, here we go. Elon Musk and Twitter. This has to be like the biggest story in the creator economy this is a story of the year.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong.
You are not
wrong.
This
is the Mr. Beast Squid Game of the year.
If you've been living under a rock, Elon Musk has bought Twitter. He's now at the helm. Mm-hmm. He posted a video of himself walking into Twitter HQ with a sink and said, let that sink in. Mm-hmm. It's been a long process for him to finally acquire Twitter. And now he's finally there. And it is a very unique scenario where we have someone who I actually consider to be a creator.
Totally.
They're very much in their own right at the helm of a major, major tech platform that affects tons of people. He is like the memer in chief, the shit poster in chief, who's just disseminating information about Twitter on Twitter, and we're all eating it up.
He has 113 million followers on Twitter, which is crazy. It is crazy that one of the most followed people on the platform bought the platform. It's so unique because now we're actually getting to tune into his Twitter for updates about the platform and commentary about what he's going to do with the platform. That is unlike any other platform. Like, we don't have a stream of Jeff Bezos. We don't have a stream of Mark Zuckerberg. We don't have a stream of Susan Wojcicki.
Well, now it's a privately held company.
Yeah.
So he doesn't have to worry about if he tweets something, what's going to happen to the stock of Twitter for the investors. He owns it.
Yeah. So first, let's talk about, just recap his motivation for buying Twitter.
Yeah, he said that he feels like Twitter is the town square, right? Or the town hall. Mm-hmm. And that should be something that is less regulated. There's more free speech and that everyone has access to.
Yeah. And he wants to open source the algorithm, which I kind of understand, but don't really understand. He definitely has this opinion, which I agree with this opinion, that a lot of what's happening on social media right now is we get into our own echo chambers, specifically on Twitter. You enjoy one opinion or one side of an argument, and you're only getting fed that side of the argument. So opening up the doors and figuring out a way where we can have a more well-rounded perspective, I don't know if that's possible, but I think the internet has allowed us to have confirmation bias, where it's like, if I believe something, if I believe pineapple on pizza is bad, it is very easy for me to live in a world where that is the only opinion that exists.
You can get it immediately on Twitter. It will confirm every belief, fear you have, anything.
Exactly. And so I think that is something that, for the well-being of society, it is important to have more well-rounded opinions. So I agree with that piece. What's really interesting to me is like why someone like him wants to take on this challenge. You know, I guess like when you're that wealthy, when you're that ambitious, it's just kind of like, do it all. I don't know. Or like play kind of this like almost God complex where it's like, let me come in and be a savior, or let me like organize how humanity is going to move forward.
Yeah. I mean, he actually tried to back out, but got kind of stuck in a more of a legal situation, which I don't fully understand, but he, in a way, sort of, it seems like went too far down the process of
buying
Twitter.
Let me explain the legal situation he got into. It's called no takesie backsies.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that's what that's called. You can't, especially with a publicly held company, go in and be like, I'm going to buy it at the share price. It's going to make all this noise. And they can make an argument to be like, you've just messed up our entire company by making that offer publicly and not
now trying to back out.
Now trying to back out. Now you've like completely messed with the company. So you have to move forward with it.
But you know, the really interesting thing is that in order to buy Twitter, what I'm reading here, he had to take out $12.5 billion in loans, which means Twitter will have to come up with an additional $1 billion a year to service this debt.
Yeah. So there's a couple of different ways that Elon is talking about increasing Twitter revenue. So when we look at Twitter revenue, it mainly comes from advertising. I think a lot of people probably don't know the different revenue streams of Twitter and even how creators engage with it, right?
Yeah.
So first and foremost, Twitter has subscriptions, right? So Twitter Blue is a subscription where you can pay to like edit tweets and have a couple of different features. It's like $5 a month. Twitter also has this advertising program for select creators called Twitter Amplify, where if you're scrolling through Twitter, you can see a video from a creator. Scooter Magruder is one of these creators who has it. Cody and Noel have it. Sarah Deechi, where essentially it'll play a pre-roll ad similar to a YouTube video, a skippable pre-roll ad before the creator's videos, and they'll share the revenue of that. It's actually typically higher revenue than YouTube, because it's so select and so condensed as to which creators are a part of this program called Twitter Amplify.
Now, I do think it's important to say, though, that Twitter historically has had a lot of problems with advertising and generating significant revenue for a couple of reasons. Number one, brand safety. There is anything and everything on Twitter. It's crazy in terms of videos. We've seen some crazy things. At any time, you can log in and see things that I personally think you cannot find on any other social media platform.
Yeah, Elon.
They have like moderation problems, it seems. So brand safety is a problem.
Moderation problems or like a decision, right?
So that's a decision
to be kind of like an open platform. I mean, I thought what Elon tweeted was really fascinating, where he said that Twitter brings out the inner masochist in all of us. Masochist is like this person who desire or like gets gratification from pain, right? And I think he's probably right that Twitter's this place where we go to find things that shock us, that are extreme, that we can get angry about, that we can provide a hot take about, that we can, you know, argue about. And that is an element of being a town square, but algorithmically and even the style of content on the platform, I think it enhances it. And essentially it's meant to pour gas on a fire. That is what the platform is. Like if you have a desire to go look at, you can find it and gas is just going to be poured all over the fire that you have inside of you.
And something that's covered in gas and is on fire is not the best place for advertising. So that is problem exactly. Number one.
Yeah.
Number two is that similar to, you know, TikTok, Reels, YouTube Shorts, these are platforms that move very quickly through content. It's a very much a scrolling behavior. It's not a sit and watch one thing for a long period of time. It's actually even faster than TikTok. It's faster than Reels. It's faster than YouTube Shorts. So finding place for an ad and finding someone who has a behavior to sit through a 30-second ad is few and far between. And it's hard to tell who should be attributed, who should get the money from the ad revenue.
Right.
So they are facing logistical problems of how to pay out creators, and they're facing a brand safety problem.
Yeah. So Elon Musk put out a message to, you know, advertisers saying he wants Twitter to become the best advertising platform in the world. Who knows how he's going to do that? I have no idea what that means. But, you know, no matter what, Twitter has not really been profitable. They've been profitable for 2 years. And they've lost, you know, up to $1 billion in a year. So it's not like it's not some great business. They really haven't solved it. They don't share revenue with creators outside of Twitter Amplify, which I assume if you're listening to this, you didn't even know existed. And, you know, there's not much other revenue to be had as a creator. The incentive to be on Twitter as a creator, I think is like, I don't know. I guess like what's our incentive just to be a part of the conversation?
Yeah, I'd say the incentive for us is to have a better pulse on the internet. I log in to see what's trending, what's happening right now.
Yeah.
What are people talking about? And it's pretty tailored to us. So we get a lot of news about creators whenever a creator does something. And a lot of times that's where news within the creator industry breaks first.
Yeah, true.
So that's really why I plug into Twitter every day. And even in the early days of growing our channel, we posted a lot of our videos on Twitter because, you know, our creator friends who maybe had larger followings than we did, if they interacted with it, it would surface the video into everyone's feed. So we were getting actually a lot of early discoverability from Twitter as well.
Yeah. So basically like one of Elon's first moves to explore revenue creation for the company is to charge money for verification. And what he's kind of put out to the world is $8 for verification. My understanding is that you will still need to apply and become verified, and then you will get the opportunity to pay $8 a month, and it will unlock additional features beyond just the check mark. You'll have priority in, you know, replies and messages and a few other features that Elon mentioned, but that has been a hot topic. Marques Brownlee tweeted out about it, saying that, you know, this concept breaks one of his rules for the internet, which is charging for something that was previously free. I asked Marques if he would pay for it on Twitter. Marques responded saying he would, and mainly because it adds additional features, which I agree with. One of the most interesting things is that Elon Musk replied to Marques Brownlee. So you're living in a world where like one of the most influential people in the world and the, you know, head of this platform is responding to the creators on the platform. That's fascinating. And like chiming into the conversation about changes to the platform.
I mean, he's responding to creators and non-creators alike. It's amazing how many people he's responding to. And even with the midterm elections coming up in the US, there's a lot of concern around making sure that information is true and that things aren't biased. And if you look at different politicians, he's responding left and right to some of their concerns that are coming in. He really is Twitter support right now, which is unbelievable.
Yeah. Hank Green also said on this notion of Marquez's tweet about, you know, charging for something that was previously free. Hank said, this is something that was free to many people, but unattainable to most. You know, and I do think that's still going to be the case. Like, I don't think being verified is going to be widely attainable. I still think it's going to be a challenge. I mean, even for us, it took us years and years and years to become verified on these platforms.
I don't know. I mean, if you look at his tweet, it says Twitter's current lords and peasants system for who has or who doesn't have a blue check mark is bullshit. Power to the people. Blue for $8 a month. I'm pretty sure.
Blue for $8 a month? Like, or blue check. Is that what he's saying?
I think he's considering those one and the same.
Okay. Got it. Yeah. I mean,
he's like, their system for who has a blue check mark and who doesn't is bullshit. Power to the people. Blue for $8 a month.
The question is, if everyone's verified, isn't no one verified?
Or is it just like he's ushering Twitter into an age of get used to paying for Twitter?
Yeah, it's possible. I think we might be entering into a world of platforms exploring charging creators. We might. Like, just envision if YouTube had a revenue problem and they charged us $1 to upload a video, we would do it.
Yeah, we've uploaded. I also think it's not even if they have a problem, it's safeguarding against potential problem,
sure.
Right? Because the same way we'll speak to a creator, and if they're overly leveraged on advertising,
sure,
we'll say, oh, that's probably a problem. You should think about diversifying your business.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If verification goes the way I think it will go, we will pay for verification. We will pay to keep our verified badge. If it is like everyone's verified, I don't know. But if this launches by the date he wants it to launch, which is November 7th, which is 5 days from right now.
Oh my gosh.
That's when he wants it to launch. If that happens, we'll pay the $8.
I mean, he'll generate a lot. It'll generate a lot of revenue.
It'll generate revenue. It'll generate intrigue. It'll generate a lot of conversation. So that's one piece of the puzzle of him exploring that. He's also unbanning a lot of people who had permanent bans, including Donald Trump. It will be a very interesting reality of Twitter, but you know, under what he wants Twitter to be.
That's confirmed. He's unbanned.
He's said it.
He's lifted the ban on
He hasn't
Trump.
Lifted the ban, but he's said that's what he wants to do. He wants to lift the permanent bans that exist, including Donald Trump. But there have been people, I don't know if it's real or not, but people who have come onto the platform with verified badges who tweet and say, thank you, Elon, for lifting my ban. I'm back on the platform. So I don't know if it's happening, but it's something that he's been very vocal about that he wants to happen. And I think in support of his, you know, mission for free speech and creating a digital town square, he has said free speech to the extent that the law allows, which I think is an important distinction and an important piece of the puzzle here. The other piece he toyed around with when it comes to the creator economy is he asked if he should bring back Vine, which is a really interesting, you know, fun conversation to have. Mr. Beast chimed in on this tweet and said, don't do it unless you can create something that actually can't be copied, which is an interesting perspective. And then there was a tweet that also went around saying that he was in talks with Logan Paul to run the new version of Vine.
That was a crazy rumor and a crazy tweet.
And Logan Paul liked the tweet. Which I think probably is Logan's world of, like, you know.
That guy, though, I looked at him. He had some kind of crazy tweets. Maybe they're all true.
But got it.
Anyways, okay. Yeah, the conversation got really crazy. I do think what's interesting is that if you read the thread about, you know, the $8 for the blue check mark from Elon, he says that some of that money can also go towards helping to reward creators.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if subscriptions let's say they do bring back Vine. They start playing ads similar to how YouTube is going to be doing ads on shorts, how TikTok is going to be doing it. They bring back their short form video and then they are heavily a subscription business and they do start helping to pay out creators that way. Maybe that is a possibility and something that would be potentially a little bit different than, you know, how YouTube or TikTok operate. They're not subscription businesses. They're not primarily subscription businesses.
It'll be really interesting to watch all of this go down. I will say it's one of the most interesting stories and it's connected me more to Twitter. Also, again, probably coming back to that note of like Twitter bringing out the inner masochist. I'm interested to see what chaos is happening every day on Twitter. If I'm being 100% honest, during the pandemic, that's when I developed my deepest relationship with Twitter because I was like, how fucked up is the world today?
And how messed up is my exact neighborhood? That's what's really unique about Twitter.
Yeah.
I don't go to YouTube to find out what's happening in my neighborhood. There are tons of accounts that are updated in real time about my exact neighborhood in my town because it's so easy. The barrier to entry to create content is so low that I can literally search my neighborhood or my street maybe.
Yep.
And I'll find something.
Yeah, it's crazy. I'm curious to hear your guys' opinions on all of this on Twitter as a whole. I tweeted out a poll and asked if people would pay for verification, and it was a resounding no. 78% of people said no, 21% said yes. I said, would you pay for a blue verification check? I'm curious if creators are being honest about that, if that's real, if the people who have the verification check actually would drop it. Because I think right now, culturally, people will not drop it if next week this goes live. And I think speed is really important to Elon because the social status of it and the culture of it right now, it would be really interesting if all of a sudden all these people didn't have checks.
Yeah. Interesting context, though. I'm reading a tweet, and take it for what it's worth, from Matt Navarra, who's someone we follow, social media consultant. And he says here, Twitter's blue check business model. If every verified user signed up to pay $8 a month, but no one else did, it would generate $40 million a year. Okay. If Twitter convinced 10% of their 229 million active users to pay $8 a month, they generate $2 billion a year.
Got it. So you need to solve how to get more people to pay $8.
Very different business for a platform of this size. $40 million, although gigantic,
is like 2-3 advertising deals, maybe, or five advertising deals.
But it's just not. It doesn't add up for a platform of this size. So that's so they're really going to be in the business when they do this, of trying to create a culture of getting these people who had something for free.
Yeah.
To now pay for a few other things.
Yeah. We'll see what happens. I mean, the last thing I'll say is that Elon's, you know, has been very open about wanting to turn Twitter into his vision for X, the everything app. I don't know why that feels so absurd to say out loud. Like it feels very much like we're in the future. Like if we're all using X, the everything app, it's crazy.
Yeah.
But this concept of everything apps actually exist today, and they exist in China. If you look at WeChat in China, WeChat allows you not only to message and make calls, but it's also a social network. You can post photos. It's also where you order your groceries, and it's also where you order a car. It actually is the everything app. It's also the map. It's everything. So it's possible that we move back into a world of like consolidation where there is one app that's just like,
no way,
everything.
No way.
You don't think so?
No.
Why? Because
we have Uber and we have Lyft and we have capitalism, and you have to give everyone the option to have a choice and to build businesses.
You can have a choice and build businesses.
How does that work if there's one app?
Yeah.
What do then? Isn't that essentially our phone operating system then? Mm-hmm. That's the one app, if you think about it. And then there's different people who are building.
But what if it's all inside of one space?
It is inside of one space. It's on your phone, on the home screen.
One space, Colin.
But how would you do that and still have...
Colin, it's X.
I know.
The everything app.
I don't believe it. It's not going to happen.
X. The everything app.
If there's X, then there's going to be Y.
There won't be Y.
And then there's going to be Z. And then there'll be A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And there's going to be everything. You can't stop that.
All right, man. Let's get to the Reddit, the real platform here.
All right.
Okay? Yeah. All right. So this question comes from our subreddit. It is from Tohir. Says, we're in a bubble. Okay, I don't think this is a question. It's more a comment. It's a good conversation starter. We're in a bubble. Hey, folks, I went to the Project Iceman premiere in NYC. That's the Yes Theory movie. Loved meeting Amar, Andreas, and the rest of the crew.
Anders, you mean.
Oh, Anders, sorry. I was thinking of Andreas Hem. As I was chatting with the other attendees, I realized we're consuming content in a bubble. Out of a dozen or so people I spoke to, everyone, of course, loved Yes Theory. But beyond the interest, we were widely different. I met people who had zero clue who Colin and Samir are.
Well, that's a lie.
Fair enough. Let's call our community niche. Some folk who only knew on the surface about Ryan Trahan, mixing him up with a few other clones who made similar content. And I even bumped into a few folks who did not know about Mr. Beast. All of it reminded me that we should always try and find new creators to follow. The world of YouTube is so large, and it's easy to think we're following the top creators while the average viewer spends their free time watching someone else. It's a really interesting topic. It's actually not so different to what we were talking about on the Twitter note of like the echo chamber or like kind of the bubble that you exist in. But I was having this conversation at a creator dinner the other night where I was sitting at this place in West Hollywood. Justin Bieber was there too. Just as a quick drop, he was there having dinner as well.
Go on.
But
What can you tell me about Justin Bieber?
That helped.
I don't want to hear the answer to this question. I need to know everything about what he was wearing, what he was doing, who he was with.
It helps bring, I didn't know anyone who he was with, but it helps bring context. He walks in, everyone in that room knows who Justin Bieber is. But if Mr. Beast walked in, it might actually be like 10% of the people in that restaurant know who he is. That is fascinating. The world of the internet and the world of YouTube creators. I was at the Project Iceman premiere with you in LA, and I had a really interesting experience with Arak. Me and Arak were having a great conversation. You know, if you don't know, Arak is a creator with over 10 million subscribers, massive YouTube creator. And someone comes up and is a fan of Colin and Samir and asks Arak to take a photo of us, has no idea who Arak is. And minutes later, someone comes up, asks for a photo with Arak, asks me to take that photo of them, has no idea who I am. And it was this 1-2 that him and I started laughing about that was like, that's the internet. That's what being a creator is. Like, he's got 10 million subscribers, but someone walked up and was a bigger fan of us than, and had never heard of him. And we have, you know, 10X less subscribers than him. And someone walked up to him and had no idea who I was.
But that doesn't surprise me at all.
No, it doesn't. Yeah. But I'm saying that's the concept that this person is suggesting, that like people do consume hyper niche content on the internet. Even if the viewership is in the tens of millions, it's still niche.
Yeah. I think also someone who's a fan of us is someone who, when they're watching YouTube, is probably watching YouTube with an understanding of what it means to be a YouTuber, a creator, what YouTube culture even is, the business of it, because obviously that's what we talk about. But if you're solely a fan of Yes Theory, who makes adventure content, outdoor content, you could watch everything they make, be a huge fan of them, and really have a very little understanding of what their business is or, you know,
or
that they may identify as YouTubers, and that someone like Arak or Ryan Trahan is a peer of theirs or a contemporary. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You just think these guys are adventure creators, right? I don't even think about the word creator.
But this is the important piece of like the fact that there are people who have no idea who we are and people who really care about what we do is the benefit of being an internet creator. My sister-in-law, Lauren, went to Mythicon in Austin. And that's Rhett and Link's, you know, event.
Is Lauren a big?
No, she had no idea what it was. But her friend is now part of Mythical and is like on podcasts and stuff. Cool. And she went and she worked in Hollywood and said she had never seen fandom like that in her life, ever. She worked closely with huge actors, with huge directors going to premieres. She said you'd never in her life seen the relationship between fans and what they were watching to be that strong. And I think that's what we're working in, is like the amount of people that we can go walk out and be like, have you heard of Rhett and Link and Good Mythical Morning? Like, so many people are going to be like, no, I don't know what that is. But the people at Mythicon, the thousands of people in that room, deeply care about that.
Yeah.
And that is the opportunity with the creator economy.
That you don't have to make something for everyone.
No, if you're making something for everyone, you might be making something for no one. All right, experience with creating and selling merch. I have something on my head right now, Colin, that is a brand new piece of merch that's going to drop very soon for us. And I can't wait. I haven't been this excited about a piece of merch, maybe ever.
Yeah.
I love this hat.
It's beautiful.
It's a beautiful hat. All right, experience with creating and selling merch. Anyone have tips for someone getting into merch for the first time? In between using
Printful
and setting up a website to sell products or just going straight through Teespring, is there is it best to start on a simpler site like Teespring? Okay, if you watch the ads on the Colin and Samir YouTube channel, you will learn about the Shopify $5 a month starter kit. That starter plan is very simple, $5 a month, and it integrates with LinkPop, which is their link in bio selling tool. So I'm saying this as someone who works closely with Shopify, but honestly, the first time Colin and I sold a product was through Shopify. The first time anyone I know has sold a product successfully on the internet was likely through Shopify. And they're making it easier and easier and easier to set up a store. So when it comes to the software to sell, I would honestly not look anywhere else. I would just go to Shopify. I would explore their social selling plans and the starter plan. That's $5 a month, super low lift. You can also get a 14-day free trial. So like, just try and set up a store, see how you like it. It's like pretty risk-free.
Something also on top of that, Shopify, if you don't know, has a huge culture of developers that make custom apps
True.
For Shopify that integrate with your stores. And if you search through their apps, I'm just looking at one right now, there is a company that makes an app called Gelato, and they do print on demand, which is what you're talking about.
Oh, cool.
With Teespring. Yeah. They sell globally. They produce locally with 100 plus hubs in 33 countries. There's 170 reviews. It's got a 4.5 out of 5 stars. It says it's very popular in the US. So that's a really interesting thing that Shopify also adds here, where, you know, this app is their own business, but they produce for Shopify, they integrate with the store, and it says they have over 150 custom products that you can customize and then sell. So yeah, obviously like we're biased to Shopify, but they make it really easy and the stuff's great. So
I'm definitely biased towards them because we work with them, but I like, if we didn't work with them, my family runs their business on Shopify. Like,
yeah.
I don't think I would have a different answer.
Yeah. We don't need to spend time convincing you that Shopify is great. It's
no,
like a household name.
But the thing that I would say is like, from an ease of use perspective, they have made it easier, and you can do it through social, which is really nice. The last thing I'll say is Shopify also integrates with YouTube. I just set that up for us. So on this new drop, we will be able to have a Shopify merch shelf right underneath our videos, which I think as a YouTube creator is really important. People can actually check out while they're watching our videos. That's huge.
Yeah.
I also saw something that was fascinating. I put it in our Slack, which was the live shopping on Instagram. On Instagram Live, Lily Collins was streaming.
Is that all you have to say?
No, I was just waiting for you to maybe have a follow-up about Lily Collins, but you don't have any follow-ups?
Yeah, I mean, I loved Emily in Paris on Netflix. I'll say that.
Okay, cool.
That's it? You don't have any follow-ups?
No, I got no follow-ups.
Nothing. Nothing you want to share?
So she was live on Instagram. And she was like with Lancome, which is a big makeup brand, and they were selling makeup right there on the live. You could add to cart, purchase, check out while you were watching the live. The whole thing happens while you're watching the live. It's essentially the modern version of Home Shopping Network. And I think live shopping is going to be a massive part of the next chapter of the creator economy. Back to what you were talking about when it comes to diversifying revenue and saying, is advertising my primary source? Like, merchandise is obviously the next big thing that a lot of creators take on, but starting to get into a space where live shopping is a part of it, or just click to buy TikTok. If you look again at China and what Douyin, which is TikTok's counterpart, shopping is a massive part of what they do. And TikTok just bought fulfillment centers here in the US where they can actually ship out products. So all the platforms are about to make this way easier for you. No matter what, it's extremely hard to build a brand, especially a tangible good brand.
But I will say, a good photo served to me a number of times.
Totally.
And I will purchase. The amount of brands I've purchased from from off of Instagram that aren't even creator led.
Yeah.
I'm pretty surprised actually at how susceptible I am to buying something specifically off of an Instagram ad.
Let's talk about YouTube's new UI. Hot topic. I put this as a poll on our YouTube channel. Over 20,000 people voted in it, Colin, which I think is pretty interesting. You know, you don't?
I would agree.
That's a good sample size.
That's a great sample size.
Of people in our audience to actually chime in and tell us what they think about something. I said, do you like YouTube's new look? The most voted is yes, new is good. So let's talk about YouTube's new look. What did they change?
Yeah, so thumbnails are rounded. The search bar is rounded. Everything looks a little bit more sleek, a little bit more modern. And I believe we touched on this on a previous pod, but also the subscribe button is now black. It is not red.
What's amazing to me is that the position of most people seems to be excited. I know Marquez just put out a waveform episode about enjoying YouTube's new redesign and liking it. So I guess people just like it. The one thing that bothers me, you can't search a creator's videos by oldest anymore.
Oh,
come
man.
On. For guys who tell creator stories and need to go back in time all the time.
Extremely frustrating.
That should come back. You should be able to filter by oldest video. The nice thing is that they have segmented it by shorts, live,
and but you know, we need to sort by oldest video.
We need to be able to sort by oldest video.
We're all nostalgic. Give us the opportunity to watch the old
stuff.
We're
nostalgic creatures. Let us do it.
You know, I had a thought for YouTube.
Okay.
A suggestion. And it's off the back of what's been happening on Twitter. If there is a really interesting Twitter exchange, for instance, between Elon Musk and Mr. Beast, that exchange, no matter if it happens really down in a thread or whatever, will come across my feed. On YouTube, there might be a really interesting exchange in the comments on a video between two creators, but I will never see it unless I watch that video and sift through the comments. So what if they took a really interesting, engaged interaction from a YouTube video and surfaced it in my feed on YouTube?
Wow.
And then that conversation may actually lead me back into watching a video. What if something on Twitter, right? A small exchange between two creators was actually them talking about a video and then I could go watch the video. I think huge opportunity here for YouTube to make the comments a more interesting place.
That's interesting. It does feel like that would need to be somewhat manual. Like, I don't know how algorithmic that could be, you know, but that now makes me think about even us testing that as posting screenshots of interesting comments or exchanges on our community tab with a link to the video, you know, because community tab posts just really fly into people's feeds.
The other thing that's great about Twitter is that, like we said earlier, if a big creator friend of ours comments and engages, then it surfaces to their feed. So that's another thing that would be really helpful for creators. If we comment on a small creator's video, and that comment generates a lot of engagement, and then all of a sudden that surfaces to other people's feeds.
Yeah.
Could help that creator out. I don't know.
I like that. That's pretty interesting. You
know? Yeah. I don't know. YouTube, reach out.
All right. Competitive Common on Reddit says, my video editor randomly quit and I'm screwed. Dear Colin and Samir, I'm a college YouTuber, around 13,000 subscribers, and have been consistently posting for the past 2 years. A few months ago, I hired and trained another student to edit just like me. Things were going well. He was learning with every video, then suddenly quit with very little notice. I now have to scramble to hire someone new. How do you guys deal with employees suddenly leaving? And how do you recommend finding a new editor for the long term that won't leave after just creating a few videos? All help is appreciated. Thank you guys for doing what you do.
That is a tough position that I empathize with. And, you know, a lot of times when you are in between employees, it does fall on you as the creator to pick up the slack and start editing. And, and that's just sort of the nature of the business. You know, all I would say for someone of your size, I know I was speaking with some creators and they were talking about Patty Galloway's new YT Jobs website. And saying that there's a lot of like really young, hungry editors there who have, you know, maybe not a ton of experience in the industry, but understand the vernacular and understand the industry.
So here's what I'm going to say. I think at 13,000 subs, you know, I don't know what your lifestyle looks like. I don't know what your revenue looks like, but I just want to go back to a conversation that we had on this podcast with an author named Ryan Holiday, where he said, what's really important as a creative is to learn how to live well below your means. I think at all times you should be prepared as a creator to edit your own videos again. Always. You should always be prepared that a creative team member will leave. You know, I think we're learning about this as creators of like what the workforce looks like, but it's pretty healthy for an employee to come in for a year or two and then go to another job. That's a pretty healthy thing that happens, you know, maybe 3 years, 4 years, but people grow in their career. They want to do different things. And also it's nearly impossible to find someone who's going to care about the work as much as you care about the work. That's going to be really hard.
And that may mean that you have to make less videos until you find someone new.
Sure. But you should always be prepared. Like when I look at our creative scenario, I don't want to sign up for anything creatively that you and I can't replicate if it just had to go back to you and I.
Agreed.
Right? Yeah. And so I think you have to look into through that lens. And, you know, one thing that you can do to safeguard this is actually say, I'm going to have an editor and an assistant editor. Now that obviously requires more finances to actually do that. But, you know, is there someone behind that person who can fill in case that person leaves? Or do you switch off and say, this person's editing this week, this person's editing next week? And if one of them leaves, I've de-risked the scenario. I have two editors. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a ton of different ways to do it. But I do think you should always be prepared. Like for you, the scenario should not be that you lost an editor and you're screwed. The scenario should be, I lost an editor and now I have more on my plate. Like now I'm editing. Because you did say that you trained them to edit like you, which means you can edit.
Yep.
So that's part of being a creator. And I think probably as time moves on, we will solve how to incentivize editors to stay long-term. I think Arak and Mac are a great example of an editor who's come on now, turned into a head of post, you know, who's very much involved in the business of the channel. And I think has been outspoken about their connection and how Mac shares in some of the revenue. And I think that is the modern relationship. And someone like Mac, who actually then goes out and does the hiring of editors, and they always say they always are hiring editors. They always have a cast of editors who are coming through that door.
And yet there are some creators who never really hire an editor to take over everything. You know, Mark Rober, one of the biggest creators on the platform, still edits his own videos. He has an assistant editor. He has help. But at the end of the day, he's putting those videos together.
Casey Neistat.
Yeah.
Even Marquez. Marquez touches every single edit that goes out the door. Even us. I don't know that something has gone out on the Colin and Samir channel without one of us, if not definitely you, touching it. Right?
Yeah. There might be something, but I can't think of it.
I can't. Maybe a short?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, maybe a short. But yeah, I mean, I think you should always be prepared to pick up the slack on editing, especially when you're at 13,000 subs and you're still growing as a creator. You should really be prepared to edit constantly. All right. Our next episode, I just want to say this. I'm very excited about it. It's with your mom, Ashley Alexander, who's a lifestyle vlogger in New York City. Awesome interview that we recorded with her, and really fascinating to learn about the business of lifestyle vlogging. I feel like, you know, we've said this multiple times, and there's been some pushback on Reddit and Twitter around like vlogging is back, with people saying vlogging has never died. I think Ashley is a great example of someone who just started vlogging early on in her career and has just, that's been the type of content. And as I was kind of looking into Ashley and her content, and I started getting fed a lot more lifestyle vlogging content, and recognizing that, back to that comment of we are consuming content in a bubble, that is a massive world on YouTube that still exists and is thriving.
Yeah. The only reason people would say vlogging is dead is because they're not consuming vlogs on YouTube, but there are vlogs.
Yeah. And I think it's also because
the zeitgeist,
I guess. Yeah. People like us, even what we cover, and we're doing, you know, we're working to have a more diverse set of coverage, especially in our newsletter, to make sure the published press is covering all types of different creators, not just the creators that are in the zeitgeist.
And speaking of vlogs, we have a vlog on the way from our New York trip where we did interview Ashley.
Vlog on the way.
We got a vlog on the way coming to the Samir and Colin channel.
Vlog on the way.
I mean, when is it coming out?
Who knows? Jesse says today, but
it's not coming out today.
I haven't watched it, and it's not coming out today. No, it's not coming out today. Okay. Yeah. Vlogging. I'll give a little teaser of something that's in my mind, and I would love for anyone to chime in here on Reddit or on Twitter. I'm really thinking about live streaming. Not me personally, but maybe me personally. I don't know. But I'm thinking about live streaming as something that Colin and I get into. I want to say that. Been really interested in the world of streaming. Really interested in, like, these Q&As are really fun. What if they were live?
What if we were playing video games? What if?
Maybe. What if, Colin, we were on X?
Everything app.
All right. See ya. All right, Jesse. Cut it.
Got it.